So without further ado, I'll pass over to our chairs to kick us off. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Kate. This will be the last plenary, but I'm sure it's not the last word on this topic. That's my understanding. I'm delighted to be co-chairing my colleague Michael this plenary, and we, especially me, I have the best position, which is just to co-chair. I ask him to do most of the work and to listen. So I was supposed to speak for 5 minutes under the guidelines here, but I'll stop here. Yeah, well, but I'll keep the microphone up.
So thank you very much. Of course, a privilege and a pleasure to be co-chairing, especially with Antonio. We've only known for a few days, actually. I grew up in Latin America, so I was, of course, familiar with your role as a champion of environmental law in Latin America. And I feel like, you know, it's already a beautiful report. To quickly introduce the topic of today's session on effectiveness of climate litigation, today's closing plenary, I should say, I think I've worked on climate policy for 20 years, and I'm well aware that many in this room have worked actually longer since the beginning of climate policy debates. But I think we would all agree that aside from the Paris Agreement, one of the most remarkable things we've observed in the last decade is the remarkable impact of climate litigation, and especially the turn to rights-based litigation. However, today we will talk about effectiveness. Many of us are lawyers, probably the majority, and we know that any dispute has two sides. There will be lawyers representing each side, invoking law, invoking rights vested in the law, objectives, principles, etc., for very different outcomes and very different interests. And so there are, of course, questions when you have, on the one hand, the wind turbine project developer that is being sued by the homeowner in the neighborhood who fears that his or her property values might drop. Or you might have the environmental advocacy group suing the coal mine project developer. And the law can, of course, sustain and provide arguments for either party. So balancing these is the big challenge. And this is in the countries that even have, you know, seen a surge in litigation. If I think of the two largest emitters, I live in the United States, the second largest emitter in China, it's much harder to envision litigation having the same impact that we've seen in many European countries, for instance, like in the Netherlands or in Germany. And then even in those where you do have that impact, as a born in Germany, you know, the Bundesverfassungsgericht's decision is, of course, still very fresh in my mind. But we also have to think about what happens when it's only in individual jurisdictions that we see such dramatic progress, accelerated by litigation, accelerated by the courts, yet it's not happening in all countries of the world. I always think of Switzerland, which has managed for decades to reduce emissions with great success. But at the same time, the emissions embedded in the products that Switzerland imports for consumption are actually larger than the emissions it has reduced territorially, because the production has shifted to China and other countries where the power, where the industry production processes are more carbon intensive. So it is a dicey question. It's not such a straightforward thing. And so we want to discuss what is the actual effectiveness of climate change litigation. And to guide us through that, we will have a fantastic kickoff speaker. But first, I want to invite our rapporteurs to provide us with summaries of the previous non-plenary breakout sessions. Kate, are you starting?
I guess I'm starting. Hello again, everyone. I am, again, for anyone who wasn't here earlier, my name is Kate McKenzie. I am just doing a very brief report on the session that we had on domestic climate change litigation. So I want to start with first, we had a reminder that a few years ago, there were not this many people in this kind of a room, right? And so the fact that climate litigation is exploding is in itself an impact of climate litigation. There is some of what we talked about was certainly that there is just a huge diversity of different climate change litigation in the domestic setting. We kind of group them in two large buckets, one cases against governments and one cases against private entities and corporations. We talked about cases in Guyana, Brazil, the EU, Australia, the UK. We talked about the US as well. On effectiveness of litigation, first, we talked very clearly in several different settings about these cases seem to just, every case seems to then spawn new cases. So that is a huge impact of these cases. And that can, in my view, also be an absolute measure of effectiveness of climate litigation when new cases continue to be spawned. We talked about novel questions of international law being considered. One example there is a case in Guyana where the government is arguing that requiring the government to abstain from oil and gas development violates international principles of equity and common but differentiated responsibility. So that's interesting. On effectiveness, we talked also the example of challenging Brazil's use of carbon accounting tricks has resulted in, now certainly during COP26, the Brazilian government has shown their new plan, which no longer includes those accounting tricks. So that is certainly also an impact and some effectiveness of litigation. On corporate accountability, we talked quite a bit about the Shell case, and that case now spawning again new cases. For example, a new case filed in Germany against the automakers. We were reminded that now, because of that Shell case and others, all carbon majors are taking a really close look at their own emissions, and they're taking a close look at the Shell case. And to be clear, they've been able to quantify their emissions and also the impacts of those emissions since the 80s. So now they're actually finally taking a serious look at them. We talked about greenwashing and corporate accountability, cases against corporations who rely on non-existent carbon capture technology. Patience seems to be running out for that. On corporate responsibility, both cases, but also now congressional hearings and other public hearings are exposing the history of denial of these companies, and also moving from present impacts of past actions to future impacts of business as usual. On enforcement in national courts, we did have some discussion around that, particularly in cases against governments. Enforcement of national judgments is not as much of an issue as elsewhere, simply because governments have a vested interest in their own judiciary functioning and also a healthy respect for the rule of law in their own country. Back to corporate responsibility, some of what we're seeing in the effectiveness of cases is pushback coming from, yes, new cases being filed, but also from shareholders and board members, and the sense that the emerging risk of litigation is really pushing some action at the corporate level. And a reminder that now it's not just the oil and gas producers that are having to pay attention to this, but it's also those who finance and facilitate it. That hopefully captures some of what we talked about. It was an incredibly lively discussion, and we talked about so many things, but that's sort of the effectiveness piece.
Hey, thank you so much. You never cease to amaze me. You've been thrown in a role in the last 48 hours that you never, envisioned. So remarkable energy. Amelia Burnett is going to take us through the parallel session on international and regional litigation. Do you need a microphone up here?
Okay, so I was in the international and regional litigation session. Our session touched on many themes related to the role the international courts are playing right now. We heard about two trends in particular. One, a theme throughout the day, it seems, the rise of human rights arguments related to climate change in front of tribunals, and how, in terms of effectiveness, it humanizes the climate change problem. Another trend we talked about was the increasing presence of climate science in these cases, the greater role that it's playing in the adjudication space, with a reflection on sort of the time that it has taken to get to this place. We also listened to a very interesting analysis of the recent decision by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, its potential ongoing impact in light of the number of hurdles that were crossed by that decision, even with its limitations. Our panel also touched on the interaction between domestic and international litigation. Lawyers have been skillful in creating synergies between international and domestic spheres. And you can see this in international law developments being reflected in domestic litigation. There's probably more to leverage there. And then finally, one of our panelists' sort of parting thoughts was that we should think about what counts as a solution as we're moving forward and looking towards a just transition and climate justice.
Yeah. So for the final parallel session on climate change legislation, it's Kate Higham.
Thank you. So we had a really rich discussion on legislation this afternoon, building, I think, quite well on some of the topics that were raised in this morning's plenary. Let me take off this mask. Building on some of the topics that were raised in this morning's plenary, we heard about the importance of framework legislation for creating accountability on government actors, for avoiding backsliding when you have new governments coming in, and for creating some kind of hard enforcement mechanism for Paris Agreement commitments. One of the things that we also touched on that relates to that is the importance of who holds the duties that climate legislation creates. Where is that sitting? Is it with a powerful central ministry? Is it with a committee that reports directly to the president? What is the degree of independence involved in duty-holding bodies? And a number of other questions along those lines. So some really important points about institutions. We also heard about the importance of sector-specific legislation in creating new incentives and frameworks to get market actors and drive investment into areas where that hasn't happened. And we had a really interesting sort of case study in that, looking at how legislation and policy frameworks have really been so critical in building the renewable energy industry. We also talked a little bit about the importance of understanding some differences between the global north and the global south, and also thinking about the role that climate change legislation can play in ensuring that actors in the global north take their responsibility to those in the global south, the responsibility, of course, for having contributed most to creating the issues from climate change that we see all around. How legislation could kind of play a role there, and the need for actors in the global north to be doing more and to be increasing ambition. And we heard from an excellent speaker from the Netherlands about the need and the push for higher and more ambitious targets in the Dutch legislation. So I will stop there because I know we've got a really rich panel discussion ahead of us. But thank you all.
Right, great. Thank you to all three rapporteurs, Kate, Amelia, and Kate, for summarizing what clearly was very rich discussions in each of the parallel sessions. I've sort of taken the right to introduce the next speaker because it's a dear friend of mine, not only a prolific, one of the most prolific scholars on climate law, but a friend that I've known and worked with for 15 years. And that's Professor Harro van Asselt, who will give a scene-setting presentation. Unfortunately, he cannot join us in person. He'll be joining virtually. He's a professor of climate change law at the University of Eastern Finland in Joensuu in Finland. He previously worked with SEI in Oxford and also was a scholar at Oxford University and in Amsterdam before that. And he will sort of try to set the scene for the ensuing panel discussion and will, of course, introduce the panelists in a moment. Harro, can you hear us? And are you with us?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me fine as well?
Certainly can. Welcome, Harro. Good to see you.
All right. Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, Michael, for this very, very nice introduction. And indeed, lovely to see you again. And good day to everyone, both in Glasgow as well as online. Now, in the past week, I've been telling a lot of people that I don't regret my decision to come to Glasgow, to not come to Glasgow. But I have to say that today, something seems to be changing in my head a little bit. Listening to a lot of inspiring talks and as well as the backdrop, especially in the last session of a massive climate march just outside your windows, I had my first real FOMO experience. So I'm really feeling like I'm missing out today. But I'm still very, very happy and delighted that I can join you here today online. So thanks again to the Grantham Institute, to the Strathclyde Centre for Environmental Law and Governance, as well as to the World Commission of Environmental Law for having me here. Now, my task here was to share some overarching reflections on the impact of climate change litigation. What are the impacts? Is it effective? And maybe the bigger question, how can we actually assess this? These are very important practical questions for litigants, for the social movements that they are part of, as well as the funders of their activities. as it matters to know what they are doing is making a difference, as well as it's worth ultimately the cost that they're paying. But also from a scholarly perspective, it's important to better understand what role litigation can play in the overall governance response to climate change. So while these questions are really important, I have to maybe disappoint some of you. I'm not going to give a straight answer to the question of what I think the impacts of climate litigation are. And my hope is that my fellow panelists that will follow will take up the gauntlet here. What I instead will do is offer some ideas of how to think about the impact and effectiveness of litigation. And having thought about this, I think whether we consider climate change litigation to be effective ultimately depends on a number of factors. And I will, given the time, also discuss five of these factors, which I think are important. Now, a first question, a preliminary question, which undoubtedly was discussed in all of the panels today, is what we actually mean with climate change litigation. And when we're assessing effectiveness, do we just look at what some call the pro-regulatory cases, or do we also include the anti-regulatory cases? And to maybe put it differently and a bit more practically, do we look only at cases like Massachusetts versus EPA in the US, or would we also consider the forthcoming US Supreme Court challenge where the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases is being challenged by a number of states and companies? Or if we use an example that is closer to my own home in the Netherlands, do we look at cases like Urgenda or Shell, or do we also look at the German utility Uniper, which is currently launching an investment arbitration against the Dutch government for its coal phase-out plans? Related to this, do we focus on what some call the holy grail cases, like Urgenda or Neubauer, or do we also look at what Kim Bauer has called the unsexy cases, local disputes about wind farms, to just give one example? And lastly, do we also include cases that never even came before a court? All of these questions, including or excluding certain cases or certain types of cases, ultimately may lead to different conclusions about the impacts and about the effectiveness of climate change litigation. And as researchers and as practitioners, we need to be upfront about the object of our evaluation. What is it that we actually are assessing? Now, a second question. Beyond the object of evaluation, we also need to look at, well, what are the objectives that we're actually trying to pursue? So maybe more broadly speaking, what's our theory of change? Now, we can have maybe a very modest goal of just getting a favorable ruling by a court, or what some may say, the winning of the case, obtaining a certain remedy or a certain relief. But winning a case may not always be sufficient. For instance, if a coal mining permit is revoked because a climate impact assessment should have been carried out properly, it may still be that coal mine actually gets built in the end. Still, litigation may delay the project and ultimately also increase the cost as well as the risk for the project developer, which may reduce its chances of going ahead. So maybe litigation may still make a difference there. And some could also argue that the goal of litigation should be to contribute to achieving emission reductions or strengthening climate resilience. So basically proving that you actually achieved to those goals. However, as you probably all know, is that doing so can be incredibly challenging, as litigation is often just but one factor in a wide range of economic, political, and legal factors that influence political or company-level decision-making. And even in the case of Urgenda, it's quite hard to actually determine whether the Dutch government has achieved the goal of 25% emission reductions in 2020, which was just put out in the news just a few months ago, due to the court rulings or due to factors outside of the government's control, such as the emission cuts due to the pandemic. Now, the theory of change may also be related to some of the broader, more indirect goals of litigation. We can think about raising public awareness, introducing new narratives, broadly changing public opinion, building support for social norms, and also putting decision makers on notice. Now, just to give you an example, while Greenpeace, many of you will know, may have lost the case before the Norwegian Supreme Court in People versus Arctic Oil, the case still played a major role in highlighting the disconnect between Norway's purported climate leadership and its continued approval of licenses for oil and gas exploration in the Arctic. And likewise, the many court cases across the world involving youth help to underscore the intergenerational dimensions of the response to climate change. And while especially strategic litigation is likely to have such indirect impacts, it's also quite difficult to measure some of these impacts because they're generally less tangible. And maybe, again, a lot of factors coming into play in determining whether these impacts are ultimately observable. But maybe more broadly about this second point I'm trying to make is here that what we're seeing, when we're trying to look at whether climate change litigation is effective, ultimately depends in part on what we want the effects to be. So that's my second point. Moving on to the third one. And here, I think that the impacts and effectiveness of litigation ultimately also depend on the level of our analysis. We can decide in our analysis to focus just on the national level and consider, for instance, whether a certain case led a country to adopt a more ambitious climate target, or whether it forced the governments to adopt new laws or policies, or whether a company actually made any changes in response to a court ruling. But increasingly, and I think a number of you already pointed this out in this session and in previous session, we also need to take into account the transnational impacts of litigation. And here, of course, one of the clearest impacts is the sheer proliferation of strategic litigation, with increasingly laggard governments and companies being worried that they may be next. But in addition, what we can also witness is the diffusion of legal arguments, which are used by litigants in courts. So, for example, the human rights-based litigation that was talked about quite a lot. But also from a more practical perspective, the building of networks of which you in the audience, both in Glasgow and online, are a great example. But a transnational perspective on litigation would also take into account the possible ripple effects of climate litigation on intergovernmental negotiations. And for example, if countries know that other countries' climate policies may be subject to litigation, this may lead them to altering their negotiation position, which is something that would then need to be taken into account in the assessment of effectiveness. Then fourth, we need to consider the timeframes, as some of you have already pointed towards. Although climate action is clearly urgent, litigation can ultimately be a long game. A court case can take many years to come to its conclusion, but also the effects might ultimately only become apparent years after the litigation has ended. This obviously complicates any ex post analysis and may suggest that rather than doing an ex post analysis, we need to do a real-time evaluation of ongoing cases while they're happening. And fifth and last, but certainly not least, assessments of the effectiveness of litigation may vary depending on whether we also take into account the potential negative effects. And these effects may include certain backlash that may happen from governments or companies, with, for example, government efforts to restrict access to justice, or the dismantling of climate laws and policies to preempt future litigation. But the negative effects may also be related to the financial costs for both litigants and defendants. And we can think also about potential compensation that has to be paid. And to go back to an example that I mentioned earlier from my home country, the investment dispute between Uniper and the Dutch government, here the company in this case is claiming 1 billion euros in terms of compensation. So again, we're talking about potentially very high amounts. So I've tried to give you an overview of some of the factors that we need to take into account in thinking about impacts and thinking about the effectiveness of litigation. And I spent most of the 10 minutes that I got to talk about these factors. But I do want to end maybe with a little personal note on something that I think, one impact that I can observe with my own eyes, looking here in the camera, looking at you in Glasgow, looking at you online, but also looking in my classroom where I see students being interested in climate change litigation, looking at the literature which is mushrooming on the topic. And what we're seeing is a vibrant professional community bringing together researchers as well as practitioners, focusing all on the how climate change litigation can actually contribute to climate action. And ultimately, this professional community can build up to what's, and I'm paraphrasing here, an international lawyer called Oscar Schachter, who was referring to an invisible college of international lawyers. Maybe what we are seeing here is an invisible college of climate lawyers. And from my own personal perspective, I find it truly exciting to be part of this community. And I really look forward to further interacting with you, hopefully next time in person. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Haro. And I take it you're staying with us so that later for the Q&A, perfect, brilliant. So thanks so much. Before I then hand over to Antonio in a moment to kick off our panel, we do have one last intervention before the panel discussion by a fellow German, Lisa Badum. She's a member of parliament for Bündnis 90 The Greens in the German lower house of parliament, the German Bundestag, and she's kindly recorded a video for us in which she'll present the case study of course, the famous case Neubauer versus Germany. And control?
Okay, yeah.
Go ahead.
On the land protection law of Germany, which you have been pointing last year. So, first of all, is to say that the Constitutional Court judgment is in the case of the rise.
Good, made in the end. All right. Okay, so slight change of sequence. Antonio, I'll let you then manage.
Oh, thank you. Well, now we begin our panel. He wanted to do the whole thing, and I was happy to. Those that know me, when I am almost silent, you know that I'm absolutely exhausted, or I cannot say what I think, which is probably both here. So the first speaker is Christoph Schwartz, and I have prepared a prepared question. I have to say that's not the question that I prepared. So that's a disclaimer. Which of the types of impact that have been discussed so far resonates most with you based on your experience? What do you think are some of the most important elements of climate change legislation to ensure it has the greatest impact in ensuring domestic implementation of the Paris Agreement? All this in 5 minutes,
so
or perhaps eight, good luck.
Litigation and legislation in 8 minutes, that's a real challenge, but I start by taking you on a little journey, my personal litigation journey. It started in a small organization called FIELD that some of you might remember, and we published a report on the rights of developing countries vis-a-vis the big polluters. And that was about 8 years ago. It made it into the New York Times. And, you know, it's, I think, the starting point for me personally. And as a result, I got invited to all those slightly secret and clandestine meetings talking about litigation and advisory opinions. What really resonated with me at the time was my colleague Rhoda Verheyen, who said, look, what we need to do first is we need to build up the literature. We need to start writing about this. So who knows Rhoda here, and you know what she says goes. So I started writing about it in obscure legal magazines like Climate Law, and I would recommend that all the youngins about you, amongst you, start doing this. You know, my parents didn't go to university, so I had no idea. But your thesis on, you know, mitigation, adaptation, whatever, use it to publish it in a journal. You know, human rights and climate change, big issue. So that would be my recommendation to all of you. I took Rhoda's recommendation, started writing, and also joined the International Law Association's committee to develop legal principles on climate change. So we did that, and I think that's really the first time a body of lawyers decided that the principles on transboundary pollution that had developed over decades also apply to climate change. So I think there is stuff lawyers can do. And at the time, I was occasionally asked by journalists, so how long will it take? until there is a successful case in court. And I have to say, deep respect to all the judges out there, because it happened much quicker than anyone expected. And there is, unfortunately, only so much creative judges can do, unless they are from a common law jurisdiction. And that's why I think climate legislation also has a very important role to play, because you hold government accountable. So it's very difficult for me to now kind of come up with the three recommendations on what good climate change legislation should look like. And I also have to say, there are small island states with maybe 50, 200,000 inhabitants. Policy might be much quicker and more efficient. You might not always need a law. But I think if you are looking for legal certainty or you need to regulate the affairs of a larger population, then law is really the tool to do this. Whether it's necessarily a climate change framework law that holistically looks at climate change, which penetrates all areas of law and policymaking these days, or you start by rejigging existing legislation, I think that again depends. And yes, the UK government tours the world promoting their Climate Act 2009, I think, but I think there are also other approaches, and maybe it's more efficient to look at the existing legal landscape and adjust it to climate change, make sure climate change is really mainstreamed. Nevertheless, if and where governments go down that avenue and decide to put in place a climate change law, there are some general recommendations, and I think we discussed some just now in the last panel on legislation. And these are obvious kind of recommendations: clear language, good structure, accountability. A law has to come with resources. A lot of good laws sit on the books and are totally irrelevant in practice because there was no money to set up the Climate Change Council or the Climate Change Expert Committee. So that's part of the wider environment, the enabling environment governments need to create. And I'm coming to this from a more from a developing country perspective, because we work with developing countries in and around these negotiations. So my first recommendation would be not to focus too much on new institutions and frameworks, focus on substance. And I think that's a bit of a gap at the moment. And the general perception still seems to be we can address climate change with win-win solutions. I don't think so. I think it's, especially in this part of the world, the global north, it's really time for hard choices. And that's where framework law could help, and maybe help government officials, judges, to implement a balance between human rights, labor rights, renewable energy, and so on. And there, I think a law can provide general guidance, just as well as a constitution does at times. And then my second recommendation, and I think that applies mostly to developing country parliamentarians and governments, is that don't look at the Paris Agreement only as a framework you need to comply with. Yes, of course, governments have to meet certain expectations. And in this regard, I think it's also really important that industrialized countries put legally binding targets into their acts. And Lavanya Rajamani did some research on this, and they're all good at promising to go carbon neutral by 2050, but they don't yet have in place the next 5 or 10 year steps. And all those should be enshrined in legislation so that one government can't just turn around and do things differently. But the Paris Agreement for developing countries also has lots of opportunities. One is, for instance, to record and document climate impacts, which then could be incredibly useful in legal cases, you know, because very often the data is simply not there yet. And then finally, I would say any climate framework act need to ensure there are safeguards. There are safeguards for people who are most vulnerable. And here in Scotland, that might be the 25%, I'm not sure that's the last figure, but who are still fuel poor. So that, when we address climate change, is something government and legislators need to bear in mind. And in developing countries, it's big new renewable energy projects very often, or the protection of forests. And in all these cases, governments are actually trying to go carbon neutral or reduce their carbon footprint, but it's farmers or landless dwellers that pay the price. So there, I think, are your three basic recommendations.
So now another confession. He didn't want to speak about legislation. He wanted to speak about climate litigation. And I said, this is a mistake. We need good scholars, knowledgeable people talking about legislation. Because without legislation or good legislation, we go nowhere. And even, as you know, judges are not exactly modest people. They are shy, but they are not modest. But you are not going to see a judge, either in common law or civil law country, that will be proudly say, I am a creative judge. That's the word that we don't use. Even the most creative ones say, oh no, all that is in the law, in the statutes. So it is very, very important to have this type of discussion about legislation. And that's precisely the message that I took today to the Summit of Legislators of the World in Edinburgh as a judge. So many thanks for accepting this. And I believe in the future, we should have begin the discussion with the legislation. And then we discuss litigation. Otherwise, we will fail. Next speaker is, and apologize for mispronouncing your name. I'm sure I will. Afijou Islam Khan. And the question is, it's not again my question. Much of your work has focused on the issue of loss and damage. Have you seen climate change litigation having an impact on this important agenda? And if so, in what way? Also, 5 to 8 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Anthony and friends and colleagues. Being a loss and damage negotiator for the last 12 years at the UNFCCC processes and considering the current state of negotiation and existing international institutions, I do realize that the legal communities need to take immediate actions and in different jurisdictions to address the loss and damage. And luckily, legal communities are taking different initiatives at different jurisdictions. So I'm working in Bangladesh. Basically, I'm a community lawyer. So fortunately, I'm now involved with drafting the National Adaptation Plan in Bangladesh. And while I was drafting a background paper, I clearly suggested to draft climate legislation in Bangladesh. I particularly focused on two issues that I proposed to establish a new window under the trust fund that is established already in Bangladesh, a compensation fund that can be a bottom-up approach that can influence the international policy discourses. Secondly, I focused to ensure the community participation in the decision-making processes, also access to information and access to justice. You know, my colleagues, I'm pretty sure before coming here, I submitted my paper, my proposal. but it would be a bit difficult to convince the experts and government officials to establish a compensation fund. Why? Because our government is not responsible for climate change impact. So why government would recognize this compensation approach? That's the academic discussion, what Christopher, my good friend, was discussing. So secondly, I would like to tell, I'm leading an organization in Bangladesh that is called Center for Climate Justice. We are trying to promote climate justice using law as a tool. So at this moment, Center for Climate Justice is thinking to file a case in different jurisdictions. So first of all, we are trying to explore a scope to file a petition in our Human Rights Commission. Even our Human Rights Commission is not so functional, but we would like to try. That is our first plan. Second plan, we also would like to try a case against a multinational company or group of multinational companies. Those are registered in Bangladesh, but mother companies registered in different countries. This is second option. Third option, we are trying to explore different other jurisdictions where a farmer, for example, who lost his small piece of land due to high tide or sea level rise or saline water intrusion and losing their traditional livelihoods, so they can file a case in different jurisdictions. So these are the three dimensions we are trying to explore the scope to file a litigation. So with that said, I would say why I'm here actually, because still we are loss and damage negotiators are busy to structure the Santiago network. You know, developed country parties are really concerned about the loss and damage negotiation. They don't like to structure the Santiago network very comprehensively. They do see Santiago network is a simple network. So the way I'm here actually to make a network. Why? I'm asking all of you to support me. My initiative for filing a case, that would be a big legal campaign as a vulnerable country of Bangladesh. So I'm here to make a network. I'm asking you to help me. But developed country parties are thinking Santiago network is this kind of network, unfortunately. But we, the vulnerable country parties, are serious about this network. We need to structure this network with an effective institutional structure that can deliver the function to meet the needs of vulnerable ecosystems, vulnerable communities. That was the intention. You know, 48 least developing countries, we proposed this network in Madrid with a broader context of an implementation arm. But we are struggling here in COP26 to structure this network. Unfortunately, just we are now focusing on the function, the basic, to agree on the basic functions. Last 2-3 days, we are really struggling. So with that said, if you allow me, Chair and colleagues, I would like to go back to Venu. But my last request is, I really need your support. Let's make a network. Let's make a beautiful legal campaign from Bangladesh, as Bangladesh, one of the most vulnerable countries. I know many of PhD students are going to Bangladesh. It's like a research hub. So I would invite you legal students, particularly, come to Bangladesh and join with my initiative. I'm really very much looking forward to collaborate with all of you. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Many thanks for your intervention, and I'm sure, considering the number of students we have here, your request, you are probably going to get more than you requested for.
So if you allow me, I would like to leave.
Yeah, please, here. Please. Sorry. And many thanks for being with us. Our next speaker is Ellie Mololan. You see, my mispronunciation applies to all language, with the exception of Portuguese, and sometimes with Portuguese too. So Ellie, I'm sure I mispronounced your name, your last name. Please, my apologies. The question is, as a practicing commercial lawyer, Can you give us any insights into how climate change litigation and legislation is being discussed and understood in commercial legal circles? Is it having an impact on the work of the broader legal community?
Thanks so much, Justice Benjamin. It's great to be with you here today. So you've said, as a practicing commercial law, I do that 2 days a week. I work in climate risk governance at a law firm called Mintrellison, but I also run a nonprofit. I'm on steering committees of other nonprofits and involved in academia as well with Oxford. So I am proof you can have a portfolio career, and I think it makes me a much better lawyer for that. So I'm going to talk about two things. So the first is, I'm going to bring all my hats to those two things that I'd like to say today. The first is how it's affecting the advice that we as commercial lawyers give to our clients. And the second is what both climate litigation and legislation means for commercial contracting. And so then the advice that we as lawyers give on the transactions and projects as well. So first point, Harrow said that we are in a community of climate litigators, and that might make us feel really special because we're all together. So I hope that you won't feel less special when I tell you that actually everyone is a climate lawyer now, and we know because John Kerry told us all. He stood up at the American Bar Association this year and said, "You are all climate lawyers now." So I hope that you feel more special because your community, you're really a subset of a broader legal community. You are all climate lawyers now. So I hope you feel that fraternity. So the impacts of legislation, we're actually moving, we're seeing that commercial law firms are moving from seeing climate change through that environmental and planning lens through to a much broader strategic and financial impact. So it's banking and finance lawyers, it's construction lawyers need to think about the physical impacts in the work that they do. It is corporate lawyers as well, and particularly the application of non-climate legislation to climate issues. So securities disclosures, corporate governance laws in statute, accounting standards. All of this means that we all need to be climate lawyers. Are we doing it well enough? I don't think so, but we need to be there. Litigation, again, please don't say I'm trashing the lawyers, I'm not, but commercial litigators aren't where they need to be, but there are some fantastic commercial litigators that do get that there are strategic litigants in this area like no other. And there is the potential and the current, it's happening already, the potential for losses of immense magnitude. And that opens up the full suite of commercial litigation. And so we're starting to see that good advice incorporates commercial litigation, climate litigation that you bring. It's actually driven by clients. And there's a few points that clients will come and ask. So government clients and private sector clients, they will come and ask their corporate lawyers, what is the risk of this happening to me? They'll come when there are at-risk letters, your strategic comms campaigns work. That's really around reputational risk. They will come when claims are brought. Oh, a pension fund's been sued in Australia. I'm a UK pension fund, but could that happen to me? It will happen with decisions as well. The Shell case was a real eye-opener for a lot of corporates that thought that it would never get up. And so corporates, not just in the oil and gas sector, corporates that have no connection to the Netherlands in terms of their incorporation or their operations, went to their lawyers and said, what is the chances of that happening to me and how do I mitigate the risk of that happening to me? So it's really driven by the clients in the litigation section and it's entities beyond the ones being affected. What are we not doing well? We are not talking as lawyers about the financial impacts, the impacts beyond the direct entities, and particularly as it flows through these litigation risks, flow through the financial systems from real economy corporates through to banks and insurers. There's a credit and investment and underwriting risks, and there's some fantastic lawyers like Nigel Brooks' team at Clyde & Co that are talking and writing and advising on this. But we need to get better. So what should we be doing more of? Well, well-advised clients that have trusted lawyers that do connect the dots between the climate science, between the dizzying pace of policy and legislation, between the dizzying pace of what's happening in the courts. They are saying, and this is what they should be saying, is that the climate legislation and litigation, it is the why behind your ambitious, credible emissions reductions targets. It's your credible transition plan and the steps that you take to implement it. That is how you avoid the risk of litigation, and if it does happen to you, avoiding liability. And that's how you get ahead of the future compliance, the policy that's happening ahead. You get ahead of that. And so it's really up to us as commercial lawyers to see, and I will challenge commercial lawyers out there to see that this is part of you fulfilling your legal duties to your client, to see that this is the legal liability landscape. These are the risks of climate change, the opportunity and the strategic value. This is the economic transition story of our day, of this decade. And if we're not incorporating this into our advice, then we are not fulfilling our duties. And finally, my second point. So what does this mean for commercial contracting? And here is where I'm actually really excited, because so much is happening within the legal profession. And this is with the Chancery Lane Project. And so the Chancery Lane Project, it uses the power of pro bono, the power of the legal profession to come together to rewire contracts and laws. But as a commercial lawyer, particularly excited about those contracts, because they create the economic relationships, they define the boundaries of the economic relationships that we know can enable the transition, can and must enable the transition, because we're going to do it through contracts. If we have a net zero target, whether that net zero target came through investor pressure or whether it came through a court judgment, because the court said you need to reduce your emissions by 45% by 2030, you are going to need to look at your scope 3 emissions, your value chain, and you're going to need to cascade that down, and you do that through contracts. So I've got some fantastic lawyers from all around the world. It started here in the UK, and we've got brilliant lawyers using the power of their pen. They are drafting together, they are hacking out, they're using their expert legal skills and developing contract precedents. We have a net zero toolkit. It's free to download. You can come and get involved, and it's up to us as lawyers to draft this and then bring it off the page. So general counsels and private practice lawyers are looking at the value opportunity to actually move from intention and the blah, blah, blah talk to implementation, integration, and outcome. And as lawyers, contracts is where it's going to be. Back to you for now.
Well, many thanks. Ellie, this is most interesting. If we look at environmental law for a moment, not climate law, the analogy that we always made in terms of historical evolution was with labor law. You extract from the big body of private law a big piece, and you bring it into public law. That's what happened with environmental law. That's what we did. And then later on, private law-oriented instruments appear, like conservation easement. With climate change law, it's entirely different. Because as the legal discipline is being designed and establishing itself, it's not by separation, it's by contamination. Good contamination. And the body of law is in fact a blend. And this is really fascinating to see that this difference with the evolution of environmental law. But let's not forget that climate law has inherited a lot that was built by environmental law. And a lot of the new formulations are, in fact, new restatements of achievements of environmental law. It didn't come from Mars. So many thanks for your presentation. Now, Alice Garland. I don't think I mispronounced her name. Drawing on your experience, thinking through the strategies for key climate litigation cases, what do you hope the impacts of litigation will be, and do you see those playing out in practice?
Well, I mean, if we start with what we're all here for and why we're bringing climate litigation, which is the goals to limit warming to 1.5, address loss and damage, reparations for those vulnerable countries, protect nature, and seek adaptation resilience funding, then I think, yeah, we're definitely on track. So FILE is a, I think the establishment of FILE itself is a sign that climate litigation is winning. We were set up 2 years ago as the world's first specialist legal regranter. And what that means is that we sit in between the endowed foundations, and effectively my job is really to fundraise for everyone globally who's trying to use the law to achieve those goals. Again, Ellie and I have worked together on a tag team on the company law and finance law for about 6 years, and this is one of the strategies that's very interesting. So again, if we're going to achieve those outcomes, how do we get net zero transition plans? How do we make them robust? How do we get one, short-term targets into the net zero plans? And we're seeing the play between strategic litigation and commercial lawyers making huge progress there. Only 2 years ago, you couldn't talk about net zero by 2050 with any of these financial communities. So I know there's a lot of greenwash out there right now, but actually we also thought that was going to happen. And the next wave of cases is without a doubt going to be the greenwash cases against corporates and finance institutions. And we're also seeing private law firms now sniffing around, and it's likely that they will come in and bring in some of those cases, which is good, really, because philanthropy can't do everything that's needed to make those net zero commitments robust. So on the corporate side, absolutely, we're seeing outcomes, and I think a lot more has been achieved in the last 2 years than we expected. It's nowhere near enough at all. That's sort of on the finance side, and then FILE also focuses a lot on the just energy transition and land use, and those cases and the funding that we do for those cases are primarily in the Global South, and they're very different types of legal action. It's about protecting the communities, and then it's using very different types of laws. So we go where the need is, and we're led by the communities and the partners on the ground as to what needs to be done. And again, we're seeing some really significant outcomes there as well. And then finally, it's the we have a rights and justice portfolio, which is really about supporting the vulnerable countries to achieve redress and reparations. And I think one of the really clear outcomes from this COP has been how much we've heard that conversation talked about in so many different forums. And I feel like there's, you know, your work, however long ago, it feels like there's a real sea change. And so I hope that there are some cases that will be brought soon which will achieve just that.
Very good. As a judge, I cannot say anything about your comments. So now it's time to move on. But before we move on, there are two things that I'd like to mention that I'm sure it was discussed in previous panels and I arrived very late. The first is that any type of public interest litigation will fail. I'm not mentioning climate change. Public interest litigation will fail if the rule of law is not present. I have not heard this, at least in the reports. So it is important that we understand that judges have to be independent and judges have to have integrity personally and in the system. The cases that were discussed were in countries that are at the apex of the rule of law, and if you will, the environmental rule of law. So please don't forget that. Otherwise, you are not going to achieve the goals that you think and you expect. My second final comment of a general nature is that since the early times of environmental law, we have struggled to convince judges that one of the differences between environmental law and everything else that existed before, there was wildlife legislation, forest legislation, coastal legislation. One of the differences was that we took a holistic approach. So everything is connected. And in discussing climate law, we cannot break this connection. Climate change law is about biodiversity too, and vice versa. And this is absolutely crucial because we tend, especially with new legal disciplines, to work by building walls. And here, building walls will go against everything we built in the past 50 years. So those are the only general comments that I'd like to make, and I'll ask my colleague, Michael, to continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonio. Listening to you, I feel I'm the student hearing from the teacher, really. Will we play the video now? Do we want to have it now before the Q&A, or do we want to have it before the closing? What would you prefer?
Hello, everybody. It is a pleasure for me to speak with you about the ruling of the Constitutional Court of the climate protection law in Germany, which we had in May last year. So, first of all, there's to say that the Constitutional Court judgment came as a complete surprise. Not even the plaintiffs had expected the outcome. And before this verdict, we assumed that there is no direct protection obligations of the state for climate protection, which can be derived from the Constitution as it exists. There was no possibility. So this was revolutionary because the Constitutional Court said that basically the Constitution is, there's already a right for climate protection within the Constitution, so which is valid for every citizen. So the revolutionary statement of the verdict was also that the court linked our right to freedom with the protection of natural livelihoods. So it made clear that the legislature must act now and not obstruct the lives and freedom of future generations by doing nothing. So in fact, as I said, the court established a fundamental right to climate protection and defined climate protection as a protection of freedom. So this was completely new. Everyone who will be restricted in their freedom rights by current or future restrictions is potentially affected. The goals of the Paris Agreement are de facto evaluated to a constitutional status with this verdict. And also the judges quote the global CO2 budget calculated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the national CO2 budget presented by the German Advisory Council on the Environment. This was also new because the Ministry of Environment has always refused to introduce this method of calculation. So this is a chance for future calculations of the CO2 budget in Germany. So what does the verdict mean for the Climate Protection Act especially? The Court in Karlsruhe said that the regulations postpone high emissions reduction burdens irreversibly to periods after 2030. So the requirement is that legislators should already now define the CO2 reductions for traffic, industry, agriculture and the energy sector from 2030, so that the path to climate neutrality is faster and better. In the end, the government acted and they put in new targets between 2030 and 2040, and also they evaluated the goal, the climate reduction goal from 2030 from 60% to from 55% to 65%, which should be reduced until 2030. But those were basically verbal expressions, and the new government did not take any new measures to speed up, to fasten up climate action. So we are still unsatisfied with this. That's we brought this up in the election campaign, in the last election campaigns as Greens, that we want to have measures to reduce CO2, that we want to act now and not wait any longer, and also that we want to have more ambitious goals. So our goal was to have minus 70% till 2030. As you know, the political framework in Germany changed. There were elections in September, and now we, the Green Party, we are negotiating with the Social Democrats and the Free Democrat Party to form a coalition. So in my view, in my opinion, this coalition has to bring a change in German climate policy, and also the verdict of the Constitutional Court will help us with this, because if we don't act and if our partners in the future coalition will not take the climate goal seriously, then maybe we'll see a lot of people going to court and calling for their right for climate protection. So in the end, there's a lot to do now with the new coalition. I'm looking forward to it. We're still in the negotiations, and of course the verdict of the Constitutional Court will help us to bring forward climate protection in Germany. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you to Lisa Badum, despite being absent, of course, from the German Bundestag. We're a bit late in the timeline, and I think you all probably feel as hot as I do. So we don't want to go much beyond the scheduled closing time in order to get out and have drinks and sort of mingle as well. But we do want to give opportunity for two or three questions. And I heard there's no questions on the virtual, so it's in the room, and I already see two here. Gentleman here with the nice cap and behind the lady with the very red hair. Let's start with.
Hello, my name is Frederick. I had a question that hasn't found its way into climate change law yet, but in the biodiversity field, there's the Nagoya Protocol. The European Union's put into place legislation to require compliance with, you know, other countries' laws on access to biological resources, and it's actually come to the point now where, like, the regulators can definitely not follow everything that's going on. It's impossible. There's one guy, and he can send some nice letters asking for information, and it'll take 100 years. But now companies are going after each other, trying to, you know, there's a place where you can call and you can report other companies for being in violation of these compliance obligations, and then they get fined and they get investigated and blah, 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 blah. And it's happening inside the natural ingredients industry, that have very high-end, you know, fragrance and cosmetics producers are trying to figure out which ones of their competitors are not in compliance and then reporting them as for competitive advantage. Because it's also a dishonest competition. You know, it's they're not in legal compliance and they get a competitive advantage as a result. And then their competitors are saying, fine, you think you have a competitive advantage? I'm going to report you to the authorities and we'll see who has the advantage now. And I wonder if we're, because in climate litigation, we're talking public interest litigation often, or we're talking about states going directly after companies, but we're not talking about too many companies going after other companies, and not for like a breach of contract or something like this, but like, if you say you have your target like this, but I have other information and I'm coming for you. So I'm waiting for that time through, you know, and this is legal compliance. It's essentially like, I tried to get an ingredient from you and I asked you all the paperwork and you didn't have all the paperwork and now I just picked up the phone.
I think I heard a question in there and it might be directed to Ellie.
Will we see
exactly
private sector as go?
So company to company, essentially litigation, and all panelists are of course asked to react if they want, but I think Ellie is probably, let's take the second one also, yeah. And that gives you some time to reflect. Please.
Oh, I have a very easy yes or no question. Hi everyone, I'm Hilda. I work on the climate case against Shell. And I think in every panel discussion, our case was mentioned, but unfortunately we weren't able to be in the panels today. So my question is, do you want to come to my event? On Tuesday, we talk completely about the climate case. It's at 2 o'clock at the Adelaide Place in Glasgow, so on the 9th of November. And we will have an hour and a half for people to ask questions, talk to our legal staff, and we will explain everything on how we sued Shell. So the question is, do you want to come? Then come to me.
Fair enough. That is a question. Thank you very much. So let's add one third question. Now it's really hard to say who came first, but I would say here. Yes, blue lanyard here. Well, I guess we all have blue lanyards, but please, thank you.
So I had a quick question in terms of the process of building strategies for climate litigation. A couple of questions. One, in terms of how much of the existing history of environmental litigation and strategies that have worked have been taken stock of and extended to the climate litigation sort of scenario. The second is in terms of choice of plaintiffs. How do we make sure that's a very inclusive framework? And, you know, is it sort of, how does the attorney-client relationship actually function in climate litigation?
Wonderful. Did you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Arpita and I work at the Climate Litigation Accelerator at NYU Law.
Wonderful and great question. I would say a pause here. We'll see if we can still add a question or two after, but to give the panel a chance to react. Who would like to start? Do you have a microphone? No. Here it is.
Yeah. I'm going to have a go at your question on biodiversity regime, where companies are reporting each other. For climate litigation, because we don't have one climate regime, you know, internationally or domestically that we're trying to get compliance with, I'm going to think about it in terms of really the emissions reduction stuff and loss and damage. And we actually have had a case that came up towards the 2018, 2019, some crab fishermen in off the coast of San Francisco. They sued the Trade Association for Crab Fishermen, sued the carbon majors. Why? Because the ocean acidification, the changing seasons is causing their crabs to become toxic. So we had one industry, the fishing industry there, suing the fossil fuel industry. And so we've had one case, but it could be likely that we'll have more because of the potential for immense loss and damage. So we do have one case. The other thing is that perhaps the reason that we don't have more at the moment is because there is just so many emissions built into our current economic system that it's hard to be the industry, the company that doesn't emit. And the third point is that not the non-emissions reduction litigation. And this is where we have litigation that's just arising as a result of climate impacts, so transition impacts or physical impacts. And we have, you know, a wind farm operator in the Texapola vortex storm couldn't sell their electricity down the line because their turbines froze. And actually, the company that was going to buy it from them sued them for the amount that they had to go and pay, to buy the electricity on the spot market. So we have losses of immense magnitude. And that's where we're just going to get companies suing each other to try to recoup those losses. It's not the emissions reduction stuff that we want. But that is happening, and we need to know that's happening, because that is the why behind our transition strategy. Everyone needs to reduce their emissions. I might now put Alice on the spot for that second strategic litigation question.
Yeah, I'll just say one thing about your question, though, as well, is that one of the other types of law firms that are approaching me now are those that specialise in fraud on the market cases. And that's because they're having whistleblowers from companies come to them. And they also, frankly, know that we're in a good position with expert NGOs globally to perhaps provide some of the factual framework that might assist those cases. So on your strategy question, you know, we work with 60 brilliant partners globally now, and they deploy a range of legal strategies from environment to climate change, constitutional, company, and financial. It seems very clear to me that they're experts, so they have been learning from each other. And then one of FILE's objectives is just to facilitate that and just to create even more of an enabling environment to learn from each other so we can accelerate and scale at pace. Your accelerator hub, you're well and truly familiar with that. What was the second question? The claimants. Yeah, again, I mean, it depends on the case, doesn't it? So in Australia, the Sharma case was brought by 8 school children and a nun, because the nun was the litigation guardian to guard against adverse costs. The children all over the world are approaching public interest lawyers, so we're seeing them. The brilliant Kate Hampton said a quote to me the other day, which is, strategic litigation is the connectivity between the street and the geek. And we're seeing that. So in the Sharma case, there were all these young children, and then when they won the case, but the environment minister then went and sort of passed the coal mine anyway, approved the coal mine. They graffitied on Parliament House, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, but they graffitied on the Parliament House of Australia, duty of care, which for all the legal geeks in the world is in this room, you know, you can see that. And then the geeks are, you know, the insurance companies and insurance law firms who are publishing these amazing reports, which are getting into the boardrooms and the decision makers there. So, range of claimants, range of cases, but strategic litigation is driving decision making at all those different levels. Yeah.
There's nothing that would stop the parties to the Paris Agreement or the UNFCCC to set up national contact points, for instance, as you know. I think they've done that under the OECD on human rights, which leads me to your question about strategy. I think, talking about future strategies, legal strategies, that's the one bit that's currently missing, connecting litigation to the international process and this event that's taking place in Glasgow at the moment. And we as legal advisors occasionally get a draft of the COP decision. And then they want to know, well, what else can we mention here? And I remember a couple of years ago suggesting, well, why don't you say something about welcoming or recalling or appreciating the input of the legal community and in particular judges, for instance. But it didn't go anywhere. Story of my life. No one listens.
Thank you to the panelists. I'll also check with Haro if he wanted to weigh in on the questions. Haro, not sure you're still there. No? Any additions?
Yes, I was trying to reach out to let you know that I have to run to actually put my daughter to bed in a second. This is the challenge of working from home, I guess. I don't have anything to respond to the questions from the audience, but maybe one thing also going back to what Ellie was talking about we're all climate lawyers now. And I think that is, in a way, that's a great development in terms of awareness. That we are increasingly aware that the effects of climate change itself, the impacts of climate change, as we were talking about, but also the impacts of climate policies and increasing ambition, are trickling down to all areas of law, whether you're a commercial lawyer or whether you're a criminal lawyer, whether you're a private lawyer, like all of these areas will come into play. And I think that is a major development. I do at the same time, and this is maybe to an opportunity to clarify what I was talking about, when I'm talking about this community, is really the community of people where maybe in the past we'd had human rights lawyers, we've had in corporate lawyers, we've had maybe public lawyers and environmental lawyers all doing their own little thing. What you're seeing here, and again, I think you and Darun are probably good evidence of that, is them coming together to share knowledge, share ideas, share legal arguments that might apply in different cases. And again, for me, that's the exciting part that we're seeing, that we're bringing together these people so that are all committed to ultimately achieving the goal. They might disagree with how exactly it should be achieved, but I think that is, for me, the exciting development that that I'm seeing here. So thanks again, and now I really have to head off. So good luck and enjoy the drinks.
Say hi to Erin. Thank you, Harold. And I know there were other questions. I would encourage you to hold on to them and raise them with the panelists, the speakers outside at in the reception. It's my pleasure now to hand over to Antonio to introduce our wrap-up speaker, but not, of course, before thanking our speakers, panelists, the audience, the good questions, and everybody on the scene and behind the scene that made this possible. Antonio.
Thank you, Michael. In about 1 month, Supreme Court judges, justices, and senior judges will be getting together from all over the world to discuss precisely the issues that you have been discussing here among us. So it's important to mention that judges are studying and discussing among us those very complex issues. The closing will be done by someone that you all know well. She doesn't need any introduction. Professor Christina Foyd is, as you know, someone that brings together private law, public law, climate law, biodiversity law, from an academic perspective, but also from her several positions as a negotiator representing Norway. But she does care enormously about the impact, the real impact of law in practice. So it's not someone that's just there dreaming about the very best possible ways of designing conventions and laws, but she is someone that is interested in results. And I think this defines the very best scholar, one that has a strong intellect, but at the same time, a close attachment to life and to solve issues, conflicts, and to avoid them. So, Professor Christina Voigt, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Antonio. Where do you go from here after such an introduction? You are very kind, and I hope I can live up to the expectation. Well, I was invited to wrap up the wonderful conference here today, and I guess this is very, very difficult to do in any case, given the richness of the discussions today. But if you only come to the wrap-up session, it's even more difficult to wrap it up. So I can't really do this. So for that reason, I would like to do something slightly different, if I may. And I'll be quick. I'll be quick. I know I'm between you and the drinks. This is actually the second time I'm here in this beautiful auditorium. And the first time I was here was in January 2016. And it was the first time that I was invited to speak
at a public event here at the Strathclyde University about the newly adopted Paris Agreement. And God, was I excited. It was so good to talk about it. I worked as a negotiator for the Norwegian delegation, by the way, I'm speaking here in my personal capacity. And it was the first time that this agreement was explained to the public and discussed and criticized and praised, and it was a very beautiful moment, and Michael was here as well. I hope you remembered it equally. And for that reason, I would like to spend a couple of minutes maybe on this one question that I found here in the wrap-up session about the linkage between climate litigation and the implementation of the Paris Agreement, which was, who would have thought 5-6 years ago that we would see this wave coming at us in terms of litigation all over the world, and many of these cases using the Paris Agreement, not entirely, many other legal bases, but many also rely on the legal argumentation in one way or the other based on the Paris Agreement. Now, I dare say, of course, there is no single strategy to bring about the changes that are necessary to implement the Paris Agreement. That's clear. It's an all hands on board transformation that we need to see, and we need laws, we need legislation, absolutely. It has to be fair, it has to be effective, it has to matter, and we have to implement and comply with and enforce what we have, but we also have to do more, and I think here litigation is going to play a very important role now and in the future. And human rights-based litigation, rights-based litigation has been very important. We've seen a number of successes. It has been pushing the envelope, clarifying some procedural elements, clarifying some standards of care, substantive elements in terms of duty of care, positive obligations, fair share. I have to admit that was something that surprised me the most, that an issue that was never able to be resolved on the international level, what would be national allocation for each state under international law, that was just a no-go in the Paris Agreement negotiations, seems to be something that now courts are taking up and finding an answer to by using different sources of scientific input. But I think there are some elements that still require or provide some food or maybe drinks for thought. And I had initially 10 elements and I cut them down to 4, and I just want to share them briefly with you. One thing is, I think we are looking probably more and more at the very difficult weighing of different rights against each other, where we have cultural rights, for example, against climate-based rights, property rights, against environmental rights, area-based rights. We've had recently a very interesting case in Norway where, again, a wind farm was declared illegal by the Supreme Court because it violated cultural rights of the Sami people under the ICCPR Article 26. And I think we'll probably see more of this difficult weighing of different rights that courts will have to deal with. The second element is, I think we have to have a very close look at carbon neutrality. It is something that is handed out slightly. We see it everywhere in the city now in all sorts of posters, but I think we have to look very closely at what science says about carbon neutrality or climate neutrality. First of all, it is global carbon neutrality by 2050, and that means that some states will have to go earlier and deeper carbon neutral than others in order to get everyone to carbon neutrality by 2050. There's an element of equity here, of responsibility, of capacity that has not yet been explored really by the legal community. Also, yeah, we saw that it's linked to early measures, how to act in the immediate future, but there is also a past 2050 element to it, because science says we have to stay negative thereafter. Carbon neutrality is just one point on the trajectory down to negative emissions. And again, that's something hasn't been explored in much detail, but it plays into much of the litigation that we're seeing right now. There are many more elements to it, but have a close look at carbon neutrality, how to measure it, how to make actually sure that this is also translating in real and sustained emission reductions. The third element is use the Paris Agreement. Absolutely, use the Paris Agreement more and better. It has been applied, but primarily by drawing in the global temperature targets. That's important, but there are two more targets. There's an adaptation goal and a finance goal in Article 2, paragraph 1, litera B, and then litera C, making finance flows consistent with low greenhouse gas and climate resilient development. What does it mean? What normative element and force is in that third goal of the Paris Agreement? Again, that's something that is flying a little bit under the radar, but could be explored much more. The same with the elements that push up ambition, Article 4.3. I've heard several times today, non-regression. Now, Paris Agreement doesn't talk about non-regression, it talks about progression. It doesn't just mean not going backward, it means going forward and higher in ambition every time. It's a significant difference. The same with highest possible ambition in the same paragraph. I can tell you there is a whole negotiation history to it. Before, in February, before the Paris Agreement was adopted, there was a draft which said parties shall act with due diligence, and accordingly, their NDCs will reflect their best efforts or slash highest possible ambition. Now, climate negotiators weren't quite familiar with the concept of due diligence, and they just didn't quite catch what that meant, so that fell out. But the idea of highest possible ambition, of best efforts, remained there, and I think there's a potential still that can be used in litigation. Same with long-term strategies, the global stocktake. These are elements that are just about to be kicked off in the agreement, and they also have some elements to litigation. And my final point is something that I think Hara mentioned just now, is the linkage to other international regimes, CBD, international trade law, investment law, UNCLOS, law of the sea. There are many, or just general public international law prohibitions to transboundary harm. How does the Paris Agreement link to these other regimes? How can it inform the obligations there and vice versa? I think there's a lot that still can be explored, because by the end of the day, it all needs to pull in the same direction in order to address that global challenge we all face and to bring about the lasting behavioral change in paradigms and eventually in values. Thank you very much.